and continue the last thing, County Sligo. Bloom saying, if any new messiahs come, it's probably an Irishman. Good. And then we read, I propose.
I propose, our hero eventually suggested, after mature reflection, while prudently pocketing her photo, as it's rather stuffy here. You just come with me and talk things over. My diggings are quite close in the vicinity. You can't rig that stuff. Wait, I'll just pay this lot. The best plan clearly being to clear out, the remainder being plain sailing, he beckoned, while prudently pocketing the photo, to the keeper of the shanty, who didn't seem to... Yes, that's the best, he assured Stephen, to whom, for the matter of that brazen head, or him, or anywhere else, was all more or less. All kinds of utopian plans were flashing through his, Bloom's, busy brain. Education, the genuine article, literature, journalism, prize tidbits, up-to-date billing, hydros and concert tours in English watering resorts, packed with theatres, turning money away, duets in Italian with an accent perfectly true to nature, and a quantity of other things. No necessity, of course, to tell the world and his wife from the housetops about it, and a slice of luck. An opening was always wanted because he more than suspected he had his father's voice to bank his hopes on, which was quite on the cards he had. So it would be just as well, by the way, no harm, to trail the conversation in the direction of that particular red herring, just to... The cabbie read out of the paper he'd got hold of that the former viceroy, Earl Cadogan, had presided at the Cab Drivers Association dinner in London somewhere. The silence, with a yawn or two, accompanied this thrilling announcement. Then the old specimen in the corner, who appeared to have some spark of vitality left, read out that Sir Anthony MacDonald had left Euston for the Chief Secretary's Lodge, or words to that effect, to which absorbing piece of intelligence, Echo answered, why? Give us a squint to that literature, grandfather, the ancient mariner put in, manifesting some natural impatience. Unwelcome, answered the elderly party thus addressed. The sailor lugged out from a case he had a pair of greenish goggles, which he very slowly hooked over his nose and both ears. Are you bad in the eyes? The sympathetic personage, like the town clerk, queried. Why, answered the seafarer with the tartan beard, who seemingly was a bit of a literary cove in his own small way, staring out of sea-green portholes, as you might well describe them as, I use goggles reading, sand in the Red Sea, done that. One time I could read a book in the dark, man was speaking. The Arabian Nights Entertainment was my favourite, and Red as a Rose She.
No. I propose our hero, and again the different appellation, our hero, eventually suggested, after mature reflection, while prudently pocketing her photo, as it's rather stuffy here, you just come with me and talk things over, an invitation to Stephen to come to his home. My diggings are quite close in the vicinity. You can't find your stuff. Wait, I'll just play this out. So he says, come home. My diggings, now digging is an English word for where I live. I believe that there's more to it because in the 19th century, a rich German, Schliemann, thought there must be something to these Homeric tales, and he started archaeology. He was the first and wanted to dig up Troy, and he found something which he thought was Troy. So archaeology, I think, is a little bit, which had the effect that these Homeric epics, folk epics, suddenly turned out to have a basis in fact. Whether it's exactly what Schliemann discovered is another thing, but archaeology has been on the map since that time. And what we're doing, also I, is in some part also kind of literary archaeology, digging up the past. Wait, I'll just pay this lot. The best plan clearly being to clear out, and again clearly clear, the remainder being plain sailing, he beckoned, while prudently pocketing the photo, to the keeper of the shanty, who didn't seem to Yes, that's the best, he assured Stephen. To whom, for the matter of that, brazen head or him or anywhere else was more or less to this is a literary quotation that comes just now. Brazen head is also the oldest pub in Dublin. All kinds of utopian plans were flashing through Bloom's busy brain. Education, the genuine article, literature, journalism, price bitwits, up-to-date billing, hydros and concerts and English watering resorts, packed the theatres, turning money away, duets in Italian with the accent perfectly true to nature. What is an accent perfectly true to nature? And a quantity of other things, no necessity, of course, to tell the world and his wife from the housetops about it, and a slice of luck. An opening was all that was wanted, because he, more than he suspected, he, Stephen, had his father's voice to bank his hopes on, which was quite on the cards he had. So it would be just as well, by the way, no harm, to trail the conversation in the direction of that particular red herring. Just now, red herring, you say, it's neither flesh, there's no fish nor flesh, no good red herring, but the herring is often used to cross against the trail of a fox. You know, in fox hunting, the hounds follow the trail. But if you want to spoil it, you have a herring across, and that confuses the foxes. So it just does not give them a good tip about the direction. The cabbie read out of the paper he had got hold of that the former Viceroy Earl Cardigan had presided at the Cop Drivers Association in London somewhere. This is a kind of absolutely boring news. Silence with a yawn or two accompanied this thrilling announcement. Then the old specimen in the corner, who appeared to have some spark of idea left, read out that Sir Anthony Macdonald had left Euston for the Chief Secretary's Lodge, or was to that effect. Euston is the station that takes you to Wales, where you take the boat to Dublin. So Euston is it's basically the London base for Dublin. To which absorbing piece of intelligence, our echo answered, "Why?" And that is a remote quotation, or at least an echo, from a poem by Lord Byron. "Give us a squint on that literature, grandfather." The Ancient Mariner, and we know where that is from, Coleridge's poem, put in, manifesting some natural impatience. "And welcome," answered the elderly party thus addressed. The sailor lugged out from a case he had a pair of greenish goggles, spectacles, which he very slowly hooked over nose and both ears. "Are you bad in the eyes?" the sympathetic personage, like the town clerk, queried. "Why," answered the seafarer with a tartan beard, who seemingly was a bit of a literary cove in his own small way, staring out of sea-green portholes, the spectacles, as you might well describe them as, "I use his goggles reading." By the way, as I said before, I don't quite know what dialect or diction this meant. "I use his goggles," is certainly nothing Irish in it. "I use his goggles. Sand in the Red Sea, done that. One time, I could read in a book in the dark. Manner of speaking. The Arabian Nights Entertainment was my favourite, and read as a rosy sea." So this was reading. Arabian Nights Entertainment. Arabian Nights, as you know, is 1001 Nights. Thereupon, he poured the journal open and poured upon Lord only knows what, found drowned, or the exploits of King Willow. So these are things, found drowned, they were all drowning cases. The exploits of King Willow is cricket news. Cricket bats are made of willow, and so cricket is King Willow. Ironmonger, having made 100, that was a cricketer. And these facts were in the newspaper. Made 100 and something, second wicket, not out. That's all cricket terminology. For Notts, Nottinghamshire. During which time, completely regardless of Ironmonger, the cricketer, the keeper was intensely occupied with loosening an apparently new or second-hand boot, which manifestly pinched him as he muttered against whoever it was, so was it. All of them who were sufficiently aware enough to pick up by their facial expressions, that is to say, either simply looking on glumly or passing a trivial remark. This is a kind of embarrassment because, as we heard, the innkeeper may be the historical Skinder Goat who took a marginal part in the Phoenix murders. Yeah, then, and that's an interesting phrase here in this chapter, to cut the long story short. What's been the situation? Broom, it's a broom, Grassman's situation, was the first to rise to his feet so as not to outstay their welcome, having first and foremost being as good as his word, that he would foot the bill for the occasion, taking the wise precaution of unobtrusively motioning to mine host as a parting shot, a scarcely perceptible sign when the others were not looking, to the effect that the amount due was forthcoming, making a grand total of fourpence, the amount he deposited unobtrusively in four coppers, literally the last of the Mohicans, he had been previously spotted on the printed prices for all who ran to read, opposite him in unmistakable figures, coffee, tuppence, confection, ditto, and honestly well worth twice the money he had once in a way, as Weatherup used to remark. So they leave him, and here you can again see the attempt to turn this into a dangerous, perilous adventure story when he says he unobtrusively motioned. Now, these are no secret agents. They're just paying for some coffee. A parting shot. Now, a parting shot is probably a reference to a Parthian shot. Parthians in antiquity were known or rumored that when they rode away, they could turn back and shoot back. So when they retired, they were still dangerous. Of course, there's nothing equivalent here because you just pay a simple bill. That's touched up as an adventure story. When the other one is looking, the fact you was forthcoming, making a grand total of fourpence. The amount he deposited unobtrusively in four coppers, literally the last of the Mohicans. Now, obviously the word literally is wrong, and you know the last of the Mohicans is a book by Ferdinand Cooper, I believe. And I think that is the connection with the copper. I think there's a kind of link there. Mm-hmm. Well, travels the money once in a way, as Weatherup used to remark. Come the council to close the seance. Again, this is not a seance in the sweet way. Seeing that the ruse worked and the coast was clear, they left the shelter or shanty together, and the elite society of Oilskin and Company, whom nothing short of an earthquake would move out of their dolce far niente. Stephen, who confessed to still feeling poorly and fagged out, paused at the, for a moment, the door to one thing I never understood, he said. to be original on the spur of the moment. Now, I wonder whether to be original on the spur of the moment is something he says in a way to make fun of the unimportant thing, or whether it's part of the story. To be original, there's nothing original here at all. Why did they put tables upside down? I mean, chairs upside down on the tables in cafes. And here, in a book where it is very difficult to understand and to explore, is one thing that is resolved. The question why you put chairs on the tables. To which impromptu, the never-failing broom replied without a moment's hesitation, says right off, to sweep the floor in the morning. So you see, one important question in this book is solved. So saying, he skipped round nimbly, considered frankly, at the same time apologetic, to get on his companion's right. A habit of his, by the by, the right side being, in classical idiom, his tender Achilles. Now it's already brought when the keeper of the place showed the heel of Achilles, he referred to the tendon, the Achilles, vena. This gets misunderstood into tender Achilles. And Achilles in the Iliad was anything but tender. He was very, very mighty and forceful warrior. The night there was certainly an opportunity to breathe, though Stephen was a bit weak on his pins. Then, it will, the air, do you good, Bloom said, meaning also the walk, in a moment. The only thing is to walk, then you'll feel a different man. You will feel a different man when you walk. It's not far. Lean on me.
Chris?
Accordingly, he put his left arm in Stephen's right and led him on accordingly. And you see this kind of accordingly said twice.
Chris, we can start again the audio file.
Certainly, because he thought he felt the strange kind of flesh of a different man approach him, sinuous and wobbly and all that. And you see, Bloom said, you feel a different man. And we know how this meant. And then he said, Stephen felt a kind of flesh of a different man. So this is now feeling in a direct sense. Sinuous and wobbly and all the time. So it's a bit slack. And the whole prose in this chapter is also a bit sinuous, not tight, not taut, but loose, as against the descriptions in the early part of the book. Anyhow, they passed the sentry box with stones, brazier, etc., where the municipal supernumerary, ex-Gumley, he knows him, Gumley, and he is supernumerary, they just give him some occupation, was still, at all intents and purposes, wrapped in the arms of Murphy. Classical cliché for sleep, to be in the arms of Murphy. Murphy is a god of shapes. He's sleeping, but when he's awake, he's very active and can take on all sorts of shapes. So in the arms of Murphy, for sleep, doesn't describe Murphy when he's active. Morpheus, of course, but Murphy is the name that the sailor said he has. So Morpheus becomes Murphy here. As the adage, the proverb has it, dream of fresh and past as new. And apropos of the coffin of stones, the analogy was not at all bad, as it was in fact, a stoning to death on the part of the 70 out of 80 odd constituents that read it at the time of the split. So, coffin of stones, it had been said that the coffin where Parnell's body was full of stones. A rumour that wasn't true. And here now Steve Bloom thinks, stones isn't bad because Parnell, when the party turned against him, they, in a way, stoned him to death. That is the idea. And ratted him down the street, and chiefly the belated peasant class. He had done a lot for the peasants, probably the self-same evicted tenants. That was an issue. He had put in the holdings, so Bloom thinks, even they, people, peasants he had helped, turned against him.
Yes?
Excuse me for interrupting. Do we have an audio recording of this bit? Oh, right. Yeah.
Fritz, we can start again the audio file. Hmm? Is this okay?
Pardon?
We can start again the audio file. Now. Okay.
Accordingly, he passed his left arm in Stephen's right and led him on accordingly. Yes, Stephen said uncertainly, because he thought he felt a strange kind of flesh of a different man approach him, sinewless and wobbly and all that. Anyhow, they passed the sentry box with stones, braziers, etc., where the municipal supernumerary, ex-Gumley, was still to all intents and purposes wrapped in the arms of Murphy, as the adage has it, dreaming of fresh fields and pastures new. And apropos of coffin of stones, the analogy was not at all bad, as it was in fact a stoning to death on the part of 72 out of 80-odd constituencies that ratted at the time of the spit, and chiefly the belauded peasant class, probably the selfsame evicted tenants he had put in their holdings. So they passed on to chatting about music, a form of art for which Bloom, as a pure amateur, possessed the greatest love, as they made tracks arm in arm across Beresford Place. Wagnerian music, though confessedly grand in its way, was a bit too heavy for Bloom and hard to follow at the first go-off, but the music of Mercadante's Huguenots, Meyerbeer's Seven Last Words on the Cross, and Mozart's Twelfth Mass, he simply reveled in, the gloria in that being to his mind the acme of first-class music as such, literally knocking everything else into a cocked hat. He infinitely preferred the sacred music of the Catholic Church to anything the opposite chop could offer in that line, such as those Moody and Sankey hymns, or Bid Me to Live, and I Will Live Thy Protestant to Be. He also yielded to none in his admiration of Rossini's Stabat Mater, a work simply abounding in immortal numbers, in which his wife, Madame Marion Tweedy, made a hit, a veritable sensation, he might safely say, greatly adding to our other laurels and putting the others totally in the shade in the Jesuit's father's church in Upper Garden Street, the sacred edifice being thronged to the doors to hear her with virtuosos, or virtuosi, rather. There was the unanimous opinion that there was none to come up to her, and suffice it to say, in a place of worship for music of a sacred character, there was a generally voiced desire for an encore. On the whole, though favouring preferably light opera of the Don Giovanni description and Martha and Gem in its line, he had a penchant, though with only a surface knowledge, for the severe classical school, such as Mendelssohn. And talking of that, taking it for granted he knew all about the old favourites, he mentioned par excellence Lionel's air in Martha, Ma Paris, which, curiously enough, he heard, or overheard to be more accurate, on yesterday, a privilege he keenly appreciated from the lips of Stephen's respected father, sung to perfection, a study of the number, in fact, which made all the others take a back seat. Stephen, in reply to a politely put query, said he didn't, but launched out into praises of Shakespeare's songs, at least of in or about that period. The lutenist Dowland, who lived in Fetter Lane near Gerard the herbalist, who anno ludendo hausi Dolandus, an instrument he was contemplating purchasing from Mr. Arnold Dolmetsch, whom Bloom did not quite recall, though the name certainly sounded familiar, for 65 guineas, and Farnby and Son, with their Dux and Comes conceits, and Bird William, who played the virginals, he said, in the Queen's Chapel, or anywhere else he found them, and one Tompkins, who made toys or airs, and John Bull.
So, they passed on to chatting about music. Now they have their different musical tastes, a form of art for which Bloom, as a pure amateur, possessed the greatest love. As they made tracks arm in arm across Beresford Place, Now they talk about music, blue folk. Wagnerian music, though confessedly grand in its way, was a bit too heavy for Bloom. Now, of course, Wagner was something for discussion. Those who loved Wagner and those who hated him, that was a big issue. Was a bit too heavy for Bloom and hard to follow at the first go off. But the music of Mercadante's Huguenot may have been somewhere in the cross. And here Bloom is again confusing the two Mercadante and Meyerbeer. It was Meyerbeer who wrote Huguenot, and Mercadante is somebody else. And at the back, there's also a kind of, argument they had, because Wagner didn't like Meyerbeer, who was a Jew, so that was in the air too. Similar was on the cross. And Mozart's 12th Mass, he simply reveled in. The Gloria in that, Mass has a Gloria, in that being, and look at this beautiful metaphor, the acme, the high point, of first-class music as such. Literally, that means not figuratively, really, knocking everything else into a cocked hat. Can you imagine music literally knocking everything into a cocked hat? So it's one of these mixed metaphors that you are warned against reading. He infinitely preferred the sacred music of the Catholic Church to anything the opposite shop could offer in that line. So he thinks the Catholic Church has brought out wonderful music better than the opposite shop. Protestants, in line, such as the Moody and Sankey hymns, they wrote a lot of Protestant hymns that, according to Bloom, are not as beautiful as the Catholics. So bid me to live and I will leave that Protestant to be. And this is, it's not a hymn, it's a song by Herrick, and Bloom misunderstands the word Protestant because in this poem it means, bid me to live, I will live thy Protestant, I will protest, I will for you, I will carry witness for you, I will do something for you. So it is hasn't got anything to do with the religious Protestant. So Bloom once more is out of tune. He also yielded to Nonni's admiration of Rossini's Stabat Mater, a work simply abounding in immortal numbers, in which his wife, Madame Marion Tweedy, made a hit. A veritable sensation, he might safely say, greatly adding to her other laurels and putting the others totally in the shade in the Jesuit Father's Church in the Upper Garden Street. So Molly has been singing in the Jesuit Church Stabat Mater, really related song. But when it says in Upper Garden Street, the sacred, in the Jesuit Father's Church, no, putting the other totally in the shade in the Jesuit Father's Church, you certainly think that the shade, that the church is throwing a shadow. The sacred edifice being thronged to the doors to hear her with virtuosos, or virtuosi, rather. There was a unanimous opinion that there was none to come up to her and, sufficient to say, in a place of worship for music of a sacred nature, there was generally voiced a desire for an encore. I do not quite know whether when you sing in church, the audience can ask for an encore. Maybe they do. On the whole, though, favoring preferably light opera of the Don Giovanni description. So for Bloom, Don Giovanni is a light opera, and Martha, which is a light opera, a germ in its line. He had a pension, a portion, though with only a surface knowledge for the severe classical school, such as Mendelssohn. Now, Mendelssohn, for those who know music, I don't, is not the classical form, but Blue Maids means classical music. And talking of that, taking it for granted, he knew all about the old favourites he mentioned. For excellence, Lions Are in Marfa, Ma Paris. That's the song that Simon Dedalus sung in the Sirens chapter. Which, curious enough, he heard, or overheard, to be more accurate, on Yesterday, a privilege he keenly appreciated, from the lips of Stephen's respected father, sung to perfection, a study of the number, in fact, which makes all the others take a backseat. Stephen, in reply to a politely put query, probably if he knows of her heard Martha, said he didn't, but launched out into, and now we have what Stephen likes. And Stephen's musical preferences are quite different. They are in the old Elizabethan times. Out into praise of Shakespeare's songs, at least in or about the period, the lutenist Dowland, who lived in Fetter Lane, and there was in the Elizabethan somebody, Dowland, who played the lute, who lived in Fetter Lane, in North London, near Gerard the herbalist. We've heard that address before in the library episode. Who? And then you have Anno Ludendo Hausi, Dolandus. This is a play on the name Dolandus in Latin, who played Ludendo Dolandus. So this is a well-known, or I mean, known for the specialist, play on the name of Dowland. An instrument he was contemplating purchasing for Mr. Arnold Dolmetsch, and when Joyce was considering a musical career, he thought he would play the lute, and it cost from the Dolmetsch, and that was somebody who made lutes, but they cost so much, about 65 guineas, that's almost a year's income, which Bloom did not rightly call. Bloom, of course, has no idea of that, though the name certainly sounded familiar, for 65 guineas, so actually there was such a person. And Farnaby and Son, this is now, I don't think, often not the, a few of us know these composers in Shakespeare's time, but you can look them up. Farnaby and Son were their dukes and comes conceits. Dukes and comes are musical term. Dukes is the leader and comes is the companion, in the way in which in this chapter Bloom is the dukes leading Stephen, and Stephen would be the comes. But imagine when Bloom hears dukes and comes, he doesn't understand that. These are terms that he's not familiar with. And Bird, William, there was a William Bird, who played the virginals, an old instrument, he said, in the Queen's Chapel or anywhere else. He found them, and one Tompkins, another composite, who made Toys and Airs and John Bull. Now, these Tompkins made Toys and Airs, but these are musical terms. He didn't make toys for children. Toys were, as it said, and airs. And Stephen knows the technology, Bloom does not. So they talk at close purpose. And John Bull. Now, John Bull is not the personification of England, but that is another Elizabethan composer. So Stephen throws him out without concern if somebody like Bloom would ever follow him. So there again, talking past each other, have different tastes. Ah, yeah, that's how far we got.
On the roadway, which they were approaching while still speaking, beyond the swing chain, a horse dragging a sweeper paced on the paven ground, brushing a long swathe of mire up, so that with the noise, Bloom was not perfectly certain whether he had caught aright the allusion to 65 guineas and John Bull. He inquired if it was John Bull, the political celebrity of that ilk, as it struck him the two identical names as a striking coincidence. By the chains, the horse slowly swerved to turn, which, perceiving Bloom, who was keeping a sharp lookout as usual, plucked the other sleeve gently, jocosely remarking, "Our lives are in peril tonight. Beware of the steamroller." They thereupon stopped. Bloom looked at the head of a horse, not worth anything like 65 guineas, suddenly in evidence in the dark quite near, so that it seemed new, a different grouping of bones and even flesh, because palpably it was a forewalker, a hip-shaker, a black buttocker, a tail-dangler, a head-hanger. Putting his hind foot foremost, the while the lord of his creation sat on the perch, busy with his thoughts. But such a good poor brute. He was sorry he hadn't a lump of sugar, but as he wisely reflected, you could scarcely be prepared for every emergency that might crop up. He was just a big, foolish, nervous, noodly kind of a horse, without a second care in the world. But even a dog, he reflected, take that mongrel in Barney Kiernan's of the same size, would be a holy horror to face. But it was no animal's fault in particular if he was built that way, like the camel, ship of the desert, distilling grapes into potsheen in his hump. 9/10 of them all could be caged or trained, nothing beyond the art of man, barring the bees. Whale with a harpoon hairpin, alligator, tickle the small of his back and he sees the joke, chalk the circle for a rooster, tiger, my eagle eye. These timely reflections anent the brutes of the field occupied his mind, somewhat distracted from Stephen's words, while the ship of the street was manoeuvring, and Stephen went on about the highly interesting old. "What's this I was saying? Ah, yes, my wife," he intimated, plunging in medias res, "would have the greatest of pleasure in making your acquaintance, as she is passionately attached to music of any kind." He looked sideways in a friendly fashion at the side face of Stephen, image of his mother, which was not quite the same as the usual blackguard type they unquestionably had an indubitable hankering after, as he was perhaps not that way built. Still, supposing he had his father's gift, as he more than suspected, it opened up new vistas in his mind, such as Lady Fingold's Irish Industries concert on the preceding Monday, and aristocracy in general.
As they're walking on the roadway which they were approaching, while still speaking beyond the swing chain, a horse, that's a real horse, dragging a sweeper, paced on the paven ground, brushing along swathes of mire up. So, there is a noise. Bloom was not perfectly certain whether he had caught the right allusion to 65 guineas and John Bull. He inquired if it was John Bull, the political celebrity of that ilk, that the personification of England, John Bull, as it struck him, the two identical names as a striking coincidence. By the change, the horse slowly swerved to turn. Which perceiving Bloom is a sort of classical construction, that you don't normally say anymore. Which perceiving Bloom, who was keeping a sharp lookout as usual, plucked the other sleeve gently, jocosely remarking, "Our lives are in peril tonight. Beware of the steamroller," trying to be a bit funny. They thereupon stopped, and you realize that waiting thereupon stopped. Bloom looked at the head, a horse, not worth anything like 65 guineas, suddenly in evidence, in the dark, right near. Don't forget, there wasn't much light in the streets then. So that it seemed new, a different grouping of bones and even flesh, because probably it was a forewalker, a hip-shaker, a black buttocker, a tail-danger, a head-hanger, all of these words for a horse. Putting his hind foot foremost, that's another cliche, put your hind foot foremost, the while the lord of his creation sat on the perch, busy with his thoughts. But such a good poor brute. He was sorry he had a lump of sugar, but as widely reflected, he could scarcely be prepared for every emergency that might crop up. He was just a big, foolish, nervous, noodly kind of horse, without a second care in the world. Of course, we don't know whether horses have cares. But even a dog, he reflected, take that mongering Barney Kiernan's, of the same size, would be a holy horror to face. But it was no animal's fault in particular if he was built like that way, like the camel, though a horse is not like a camel. Sheep of the desert, distilling grapes into protein in his hump. Now, camels, you know, can preserve liquid and water for quite a while in the desert. And Bloom thinks distilling grapes, not that I think camels eat grapes, into protein. Protein is whiskey, self-made whiskey, in his hump. 9/10 of them all could be caged or trained animals. Nothing beyond the art of man, barring the bees. Whale with a harpoon hairpin. I don't know whether you can do that. Alligator, tick with the small of his back, and this is a joke. That is a joke. Chalk a circle for a rooster. I think if you do that, they get dizzy. Tiger, my eagle eye. They have good eyes. These timely reflections anent the brute of the field occupied his mind, somewhat distracted from Stephen's words. So for once, Stephen doesn't listen to, no, Bloom doesn't listen to Stephen, while it's generally the other way around. Somewhat distracted from Stephen's words, while the ship of the street was manoeuvring, and Stephen went on about the highly interesting road. Now, what's this I was saying? Ah, yes, he's been preparing for this. My wife, he intimated, plunging in medias res. You know, in medias res means in the middle of the story, and classical epics usually do that. Plunging in medias res. The Odyssey begins at the time when Odysseus is sent back home, and that is going in medias res, which isn't quite appropriate here. Would have the greatest of pleasure in making your acquaintance, as he's passionately attached to music of any kind. Now we know that Morley is attached also to music, but to say at about 2 o'clock in the morning, come home, my wife would be delighted, isn't perhaps quite accurate, but it's what you can say. He looked sideways in a friendly fashion at the side face of Stephen, image of his mother, which was not quite the same as the old blackguard type they unquestionably had an early hankering after, as he was perhaps not that way built. Not a bit strange. Still, supposing he, Stephen, had his father gift, as he more than suspected, it opened new vistas in his mind, such as Lady Fingal's Irish Industries concert, something going, or the preceding Monday, and aristocracy in general. Exquisite variations he was now describing on air. Youth here has an end by Jans Peter Sweelinck. So this is another composer, a Dutch one, as you can see, from the name Youth Here Has an End, by Sweelinck, a Dutchman of Amsterdam, where the vrouws come from. The Dutch word is often true. Even more, he liked an old German song of Johannes Yip, and there was such a composer, about the clear sea and the voices of silent, sweet murders of men, which boggled Bloom a bit. And he sings, and that is actually a song for Studenten Gärtlein, it's called, von der sirenen Listigkeit tun die Poeten dichten. So it's a German composer, a German song. And of course, it mentioned the sirens. The opening bars he sang and translated extempore for Bloom's sake. Bloom, nodding, said he perfectly understood. Imagine him perfectly understanding. And he begged him to go on by all means, which he did. Did you read that?
Yes, it's okay. No, it's okay.
A phenomenally beautiful tenor voice like that. The rarest of wounds, which Bloom appreciated the very first note together, could easily, if properly handled by some recognized authority on voice production. That was the technical term, sir. You study voice production, such as Balaclau, that was an institute, and being able to read music into the bargain, command its own price, where baritones were 10 a penny. So tenors are more valuable than baritones, to procure for its fortune possessor in the near future an entree into the fashionable houses of the best presidential quarters of financial magnates in a large way of business, titled people well with a university degree of a BA, a huge art in its way, and gentlemanly bearing, to all the more influence the good impression he would infallibly score as a distinct success, being blessed with brains, which also could be utilized for the purpose and other requisites. If his clothes were properly attended to, Stephen, as you know, he's wearing second-hand clothes, so as to better worm his way into their good graces, as he, a youthful tyro, that's an apprentice, and society's sartorial niceties of dress, hardly understood how a little thing like that could militate against you. It was, in fact, only a matter of mother, and he could easily foresee him participating in the musical artists' conversaciones during the festivities of the Christmas season for choice, causing a slight flutter in the dove coat of the fair sex, a flutter in the doves begin to flutter of the fair sex, and being made up by ladies out for sensation. Case of which, as you happen to know, were a record. In fact, without giving the show away, he himself, once upon a time, if he cared to, could easily have not finished. Added to which, of course, we do the pecuniary emolument, the financial profit, by no means to be sneezed at, and going hand in hand with the tuition fees. You could also make money. Not, he parenthesized, that for the sake of filthy lucre. Filthy lucre is another cliché from the Bible, schnöder Mammon, kind of thing. He need necessarily embrace the lyric platform. Can you imagine to embrace the lyric platform? Again, the metaphors get out of hand as a walk of life, in life, for any lengthy space of time. But a step in the right direction it was, beyond yay or nay. And both monetarily and mentally, it contained no reflection on his dignity in the smallest, and it often turned in comedy handy to be handed a check at the much-needed moment where every little helped. Besides, though taste latterly had been deteriorated to a degree, original music like that, different from the conventional rut, would rapidly have a great vogue, as it would be indeed a novelty for Dublin's musical world after the usually hackneyed run of catchy tenors foisted on confiding public by even St. Austell and Hilton and George, and they were composers of hymns and things like that, looked down upon. And their genus omne, and they depart into Latin, the general people, genus omne. It's a quotation from Morris. Yes, beyond the shadow of a doubt, he could, with all the cards in his hands, and he had the capital opening to make a name for himself and win a high place in the city's esteem, when he could command the stiff figure and booking ahead even the ground concert for the patrons of the King Street House, that was the Gaiety Theatre, given a backer up if one were forthcoming to kick him upstairs, so to speak. A big if, however, with some impetus of the go-ahead sort to obviate the inevitable procrastination, which often tripped up too much fated Prince of Good Fellows. And it need not detract from either by one iota, as being his own master, he would have perhaps time to practice literature in his spare moments. He had the ball at his feet, and there was every reason why the other, possessed of a remarkably sharp nose for smelling a rat when he saw it, hung onto him at all. So, still the same spell. And now I think that we come to the end of the chapter. Oh.
Okay, I try to find it.
Exquisite variations he was now describing on an air, Youth Here Has End, by Jans Peter Sweling, a Dutchman of Amsterdam, with the Frau's Club. Even more, he liked an old German song of Johannes Jeep about the clear sea and the voices of sirens, sweet murderers of men, which boggled Bloom a bit.
Wunderschönen Lustigkeit, tun die Poeten dichten.
These opening bars he sang and translated extempore. Bloom, nodding, said he perfectly understood and begged him to go on by all means, which he did.
Fritz, I think it's better you make the rest by yourself.
Yeah, good.
Sorry.
So, yeah, that's all right. So we come to the end because we heard it before. The horse was just then, and later on, at the propitious opportunity. You may also say, if an opportunity is not propitious, is it an opportunity? But it sounds good. He proposed, Bloom did, without any way prying into his private affairs, on the fool's step in where angels, the saying is, fools step in where angels fear to tread. Principal advising him to sever his connection with a certain budding practitioner, Buck Mulligan, who, he noticed, was prone to disparage and even to a slight extent, with some hilarious pretext when not present, deprecate him. And you wonder what the difference is between disparage and deprecate. Him, or whatever you like to call it, which, in Bloom's humble opinion, threw a nasty sidelight on that side of the face of a person's character. No pun intended. And the mere repetition of sidelight and side would certainly not constitute the pun. The horse, having reached at the end of his tether, so to speak, this is one of my favorite passages in the whole book. Forgive me. The horse, having reached the end of his tether. Now, you probably know the expression, I've reached the end of my tether. A horse on a meadow, so it cannot run away, is tethered to a stick. So it can only go so far. And then you say, I am at the end of my tether. So a horse can be tethered, but this one is not. So it is almost the ideal wrong expression. And then with that caution, so to speak, it's not quite accurate, halted and rearing a high, a proud, feathery tail. You know, a horse, especially in a monument and statues, raising the tail, add his quota by letting fall on the floor, which the brush would soon brush up and polish. So the imagination that something that has not reached the floor is already taken away, is anticipating it, punish three smoking globes of turds. Turd is a very strong Anglo-Saxon word for shit, that is not often, very often heard. So you see, this is quite a heavy. And then in cinematic retake, we hear it again, slowly, three times, one after another, from a full crupper he mired. So we hear it twice. What I like is three times, one after another. Think for a moment how else a horse, or for that matter, we could ever do it. It has to be one after another. You don't have to spell this out. From full he mired. And humanely his driver waited till he or she had ended patient in the scythe car. Scythe cars were antique war machine that had scythes attached to vehicles that it would cut the soldiers' feet or legs. Side by side, Bloom, profiting by the contretemps, with Stephen passed through the gap in the chain, divided by the upright, and stepping over a strand of mire, went across Guardian Street lower. Stephen, singing more boldly, but not loudly at the end of the ballad, und alle Schiffe brücken. So that's the same ballad, and this sense is not in the same ballad. It is something similar. And I've spent a great deal of time finding out, and since all of you speak German, have you ever heard of a brücken? Alle Schiffe brücken, in that sort of way. I've really checked, and I don't think it is. So something is wrong that we haven't quite found out. Now the last paragraph. The driver, and now he's certainly the driver of that car, the Sandstuhr. His view comes into foreground. So a change of perspective. The driver never said a word, good, bad, or indifferent. He merely watched the two figures. So you see, now the perspective changes. Stephen and Bloom are now watched by the driver of the Sandstuhr. The two figures, as he sat on his low-backed car, that is a car with a low back, one full, one lean, Bloom being fuller than Stephen, walked towards the railway bridge, and then you get in italics, something very strange, to be married by Father Marr. Leave it alone. As they walked, their time stopped and walked again, continuing their tête-à-tête. Now, when two people walk together, that is not the tête-à-tête. The tête-à-tête is a kind of close relationship, which, of course, he was utterly out of, naturally. The driver cannot hear where they talk about sirens, enemy of man's reason, mingled with a number of other topics of the same category, usurpers, historic cases of the kind, while the man in the sweeper car, or you might as well call it the sleeper car, who, in any case, couldn't possibly hear because they were too far, simply sat in his seat near the end of Lower Garden Street and looked after their low-backed car. Now, these passages in italics intrude because there is a song in Ireland, The Low-Backed Car. You've heard it before, and somehow from the low-back car, a car which is low-back, the song intrudes into whoever tells the story, because in the song it says, is that it's a low-back car to be married by my father Mark. That is a quote from the song and has nothing to do with the reality. And I'm quite sure this is a passage that would be very hard to follow if you didn't have that kind of particular information. So in a way, a song takes over and infiltrates the text, and the last word is looked after the low-backed car. So that is the end of the chapter in a strange fusion. With a particular kind of language that is full of awkwardnesses, repetitions, cliches, of course, and all of that, which has its own, considerable charm. Since we have come to the end, I think we should also stop, because the next chapter is something quite different. I think it's good to respect the chapter. The next chapter, you will see, is quite a different tone. It tries not to do what the previous chapter does, having all kinds of metaphors and idioms and things that don't suit, but it wants to be straightforward, clear, classic, even if it's a bit boring and without tension. So the next is the second last chapter, and it's again something that has not been used in a novel to tell a story, as you can see. It consists of questions and answers. So we'll tackle it then next time. Thank you, Porter.
Thank you.
Bye. Have a nice evening.
Goodbye.
All right.